Hello, Jez. Well, thank you for contributing to this this podcast. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and perhaps why I've invited you to make a contribution?
Yeah, great. Hi, Rob. I'm Jez. I'm a recent graduate from the University of Cambridge. I graduated just last year in June, and I studied human, social and political sciences with a focus on social anthropology. I suppose my understanding of why I've been invited on today is because of my research into the experiences of working class people at the University of Cambridge in particular, but has a greater bearing, I think, on the experiences of working class people at elite institutions, in particular universities.
Yeah. I know this is an important subject for you. Do you want to just outline why that is the case?
Yeah, sure. So, interestingly, and, you know, had a number of benefits and challenges for my research, I am one of the people that my dissertation focuses on. So I identify as working class. I grew up on a council estate in a council home that my mum had lived in since she was 16 or 17. Grew up very much as a child, in a family on benefits, was the first in my family to go to university and the first in my immediate family to finish high school as well. So I suppose my path to university in general was very different to many of my peers. And I think that has really important implications on your experiences at university.
And I can identify with quite a lot of what you've written, but also coming from the University of Chichester, which let's face it, is perhaps at the other end of the spectrum when it comes to elitism. But we do deal, and we do have a lot of students that you describe, and a big part of my work I see as being sort of providing a really good education for all people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think you need to be attending the most sort of hallowed, prestigious universities in the world for these sort of difficulties and feelings to emerge. So I think it does have a much greater, effect, I think. But I do feel that it probably is drawn out more intensely depending on the other sorts of people that you encounter, and that will depend on, in part, what university you go to. So,
I must say, I found your thesis fantastically rich and wonderfully written. I could almost sort of live the stories that you got involved in. Before we get into the detail of that, in terms of terminology, do you want to describe what a liminar is and why it is important?
Yeah, sure. So a bit of context, sort of late into my research, actually fairly late into my writing up, I was talking about this sort of feeling of being pulled in two directions or being caught between two particular understandings of the self and sets of expectations and so on. And my supervisor said, oh, it sounds like this is pretty liminal. And I was like, what does that mean? Right. I didn't know what liminality was. But quickly this idea of liminality became central, to my writing and to the way I was framing these experiences. And liminality is this idea of being caught, in between, two states. So you are in the process of transformation, having left something behind, but not yet reaching what you, are set to reach. So a liminar, as I write in my thesis, is somebody who is experiencing, that state of liminality. And importantly for this piece, experiences all of the troubles that come along with that.
Brilliant. Thank you. So should we just start talking about your dissertation? Can we start off perhaps with Farah features very strongly. Do you want to say something about the realization of difference between the world that you inhabit at university and the world that you inhabit at home. That came across really, really strongly.
Yeah. So Farah is one of the people I discuss in the early sections of the dissertation in particular. Importantly, to just quickly note, Farah is a pseudonym, so it's not their actual name for obvious reasons. But one thing that she talks about is this realization, what she calls this strange awakening, where she came to realize that life at home and life at university were, you know, fundamentally different, and her experiences no longer prepared her for the sorts of life that she would be living at university. And this is, you know, I suppose, a pretty basic illustration of, you know, much of what Bourdieu writes about. And I know that you're familiar with Bourdieu's literature, having spoken about it in previous episodes. But it's this idea that when habitus encounters a social world in which it is the product, it is like a fish to water, right? So when you are in an environment similar to that in which you grew up and have experienced all the trials and tribulations, right, of that sort of background, you are prepared to exist there. You know the rules. You know how to present yourselves. When you go into a field, as Bourdieu would call it, an environment which is different to that, you're suddenly no longer acclimatized, naturalized to the sorts of sets of expectations and codes of behavior and all the other sorts of things that come with it. So Farah experienced herself quite literally moving between two starkly different and often adversarially positioned social worlds where she came to feel that she belonged in neither of them.
Out of interest, that sort of almost a reconciliation of those two worlds takes a lot of work. And in your paper, I felt the hard mental work that is present in navigating those two worlds. And I'm sort of contrasting that with the people for whom this is their place. This is their world. Yeah. They've grown up with the expectation of going to Cambridge. Their family, their brothers, sisters, parents, they are of that world. I was intrigued. What do the likes of Farah, and perhaps yourself, what do you do to their habitus in that form of, perhaps as Bourdieu might describe it, as misrecognition? How do you agitate or how do you sort of create difference for them?
Yeah, I suppose it's an interesting one, right? I think that very much built into the Oxbridge, you know, status, this idea of elite universities, is this meritocratic fallacy, right? The fact that if you work hard enough, if you only have the aspirations and work ethic, you can thrive and succeed in whatever you want to achieve. I do feel, this is not something that I've written about even thought about in great depth, but I do feel to some extent that you can disrupt this sense of deservingness, this sense of desert, as like Sandel and I was right about, for those people, because it is difficult, I feel, if you went to Eton or another, you know, elite private school, to truly justify to yourself that you have worked as hard and faced as many trials as someone from a far less privileged background has. And yet you are both at, the same university. You are both existing in the same social space. So I do feel that that perfect sense of synthesis that exists between their privileged background and their new privileged environment can be made a little bit shaky by the fact that there are those that have, you know, as some would say, not that this would be my preferred depiction, some have transcended their environment to meet you in your more privileged one. So I do think that there could be a disruption there, but my view mostly is that those that come from these hyper-privileged backgrounds generally try to find ways to justify, you know, the struggles that they might have experienced, to present themselves as equally deserving and having, you know, gone through the same, you know, Herculean, you know, challenges to get there, right? Which is not true, but I think people try to present that as being the truth.
I know we're only partway into this, into the conversation. I'd like to sort of get onto the subject of why you think this is important. Why is it important from an individual perspective, an institutional perspective, and from a wider policy educational perspective? I know it might sound obvious, but I want to sort of really understand and why it is important.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it sort of is a little bit obvious, but also if it was super obvious, then it would have been sorted out, right? So
yeah.
I think that part of the issue is that I think that social mobility, which we could, you know, always talk about, my thoughts on that another time or later on, has started to focus as much, or is focusing as much on getting on as it is on getting in. But I feel that universities, and this is sort of a bit of a negative view, really, but sometimes I feel that they focus a lot on access and wider than participation. But importantly, I don't think that should stop at the point of admission, right? You know, getting in people who are under-resourced, who come from difficult socioeconomic backgrounds where they've, you know, had to get through a lot to get there, is really important and fantastic work. But to abandon them at the point of entry is really quite, you know, is a real failure. And I don't think that it's completely true to say that is what happens. But I do think more work needs to be done to support people from under-resourced backgrounds, from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, from working class backgrounds, through the process. And there's a number of ways I think that could be done.
I was really struck with one of the participants, I think it might have been Farrow again, actually, in the issue of being offered an internship at an embassy. I mean, what an opportunity. But for that participant, they felt, well, can you describe how they navigated that offer, which would have been a brilliant offer?
Yeah, so I actually remember vividly having this conversation with Farah, and I was like, oh my God, why did you not take it? I was like, what are you doing? And like, I just sort of had this moment where I was like, this sounds like a really great opportunity. But, you know, it was more than just a issue of finances or those sorts of things. We've seen a lot of coverage recently about the fact that, you know, 61% of internships are unpaid or underpaid, which means there's a huge barrier for people from, you know, low income backgrounds from taking them up. There is this issue as well. But what I write about here is that Farah is presented this opportunity or this offer from a friend who has a parent, I believe, who worked at an embassy, who they knew could get an internship for them. But they turned it down because they did not feel worthy of that opportunity. And that sense of feeling worthy was not necessarily entirely just about having not applied in some formal sense, but it was also, you know, this feeling of prestige and power that embassies hold. We know that, you know, the diplomatic service in civil service and these foreign affairs roles are really sought after, but are understood to be massively dominated and occupied by people from really extremely privileged backgrounds. So there was almost this opting out this self-selection that was occurring there, where they chose not to pursue what would otherwise have been a really meaningful and I think important opportunity.
What struck me about that story, I was thinking that from my perspective as a tutor and as a lecturer and somebody who works in a university, what could I do? And you could imagine some form of support for Farah to enable her to think differently. I mean, do you have any thoughts around what could be done practically for her to see her world in a different light, so she could make the most of those opportunities?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, one thing about going to places like Oxford and Cambridge and elsewhere is you do sort of forcefully have to get used to encountering and conversing with people in these like high status positions, right? Because you will have one-to-ones with these like great elite academics who are top of their field. So I think there is a sense to which you become acclimatized and more comfortable in doing that. But I don't think that necessarily transfers into feeling able or deserving to network and to reach out and try to secure opportunities. That can feel quite intimidating. So in terms of what could be done, I think it would be really great for more opportunities to be run and for colleges and the university at large to reach out to alumni and provide spaces and events for people from, lower socioeconomic backgrounds to engage with them and to almost potentially demystify some of the elements of networking and so on. Because I think so many people I spoke to at university would be like, I don't really know what networking is. And it comes across as this like real secret thing that you have to figure out and crack. But for people that are used to it, for people whose parents are senior solicitors or magistrate circle firms or barristers or their doctors or whatever it is, you encounter these people throughout your life at random intervals because your parents are just friends with them. Yeah. Whereas for me, I'd never met a doctor other than my GP. I'd never met a lawyer at all. I never met a banker. I never met any of these people. So I don't know what I'm meant to say to them. I don't know, I might feel undeserving of even speaking to them and asking for, an opportunity to learn from them. So I think more can be done. And I know that the Career Service at Cambridge do some work, but I never feel that it's, it can be a complete project.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing that is that these issues are so subtle, aren't they? I mean, I think you talk around, those subtle cues around cutlery and even the words like matriculation formal and, that's the sort of structure of the university. But some of these things around social capital are so subtle that it almost defies it defies a glossary, doesn't it? You couldn't do a glossary because even if you were to write these things down, it's in the way that these things are talked about as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, things like formals and matriculation formal, which is, when you join the university, you become a member of the university. You're never really taught how to navigate these things, right? And even networking events, careers events, they're often run with canapes or with glasses of Prosecco and stuff. And so that's such a weird thing in itself, right? Being invited to a networking event and being offered, sometimes quite a large amount of free alcohol or, to have these really, really great free pieces of food and so on. And that can, I think, really change the, and it's great. I'm not encouraging that they stop that. I mean, students enjoy it and it encourages them to go and so on. But, if you're not used to that sort of thing, you don't know, how much should I be drinking? Is it rude if I don't drink, and so many of these small little questions can occupy too much of the bandwidth for you to be really taking full grasp of the opportunity. I know that we spoke before about matriculation formals, and I kind of glossed over in another piece of writing what one was, taking it to be sort of, you know, universal knowledge, because, you know, I'm so used to, in the Cambridge bubble, as they call it, to everyone understanding that. But, you know, even I remember my matriculation formal quite vividly. And I remember our master, the person in charge of the college, very well intentionally talking about, making some sort of slightly jovial comment, but it was actually helpful, about how to use the cutlery and, you know, work. Is it working your way in? I think, yeah, working your way in, or out. I can't actually remember which way around it is. But, you know, although well-intentioned, I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, well, do people just know how to do this then? Like, is it, because the point she was making is not everybody does. So even in trying to make it feel more accessible and like to, you know, you might not be the only one, there was an immediate sort of establishing of the haves and the have-nots, those that did already know, those that didn't already know. And I think, you know, that is one of those issues that has to be navigated, is how do you actually meaningfully help people to navigate these spaces and these events without separating them from the pack, in sort of suggesting that, you know, you need a bit of extra attention or you need this help or whatever, which I think is a much broader thing that needs to be thought about.
Perhaps it might be, let's just sort of shift the conversation slightly and perhaps focus a little bit more around what can we do at a university to actually sort of support this agenda more. And I know you sort of push against this sort of highly institutionalized response and formulaic responses to these things, but, you know, in terms of some sort of summary part of the conversation, I just want to come back to what is it that we can do? What is it that we can do? Jez, help me out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question that I don't pretend to have cracked, of course. But I think there are a number of really important things, right? So in my research, the things that I identify as being really important is, you know, this feeling of feeling out of place, like an imposter, is something that we speak about a lot. Of course, with universities, particularly those that are a really high caliber, this feeling of being an imposter within, sort of like hiding away in the cracks a little bit. But for these people from working class backgrounds who are attending Cambridge, because of the narratives around social mobility and so on and so forth, they begin to feel like they are really suspended between two sets of ideals, two communities, and two places, which can be really mentally troubling, like really quite an emotional strain, require a lot of you know, effective labor to navigate and to move on with you know, your studies and to try and keep a sense of self that is valued by, you know, by others and by yourself. So there are a lot of, you know, sort of, I think, unspoken or ignored struggles that people from working class backgrounds face at Cambridge. So that's the context, I think, where work needs to be done. So first thing, I think, is, of course, continuing projects around wider participation. So although I said earlier, this is not the be all and end all, we shouldn't be treating access as stopping at the moment of entry. It needs to be a more continuous process. I do think that there is still a huge amount of work to be done to make Cambridge and Oxford and other universities reflective of the population and really ensuring that this almost legacy that exists, where if your parents went, you're more likely to get in. If you went to this certain school, you're more likely to get in. That stops, because I feel that if Cambridge were to be more reflective of broader society in its makeup, then people wouldn't feel so, so much like an imposter. People wouldn't feel so much that they didn't deserve to be there, because there would be more people like them. This idea of people like me is really important. Who are currently there, who have come before them, and the knowledge that they will come after them as well. So I think that is an important bit of work that is being done, but needs to be done potentially to a greater standard, although I understand that it is a really complex issue. I think that from that point, students need to be better supported in the transition process. So some colleges have introduced what's called a bridging week, which is invite students to attend a week earlier, where they will be slightly eased into the process. So they will be shown around the university structure, will be explained to them. A lot of these terms and things like formals will be experienced and understood before everybody else arrives. So there isn't necessarily such a haves and have nots feeling, you know, overtly. You can't see it so overtly because you become aware of how to navigate these spaces a little bit earlier, which I think is really important. I know that not every college has a bridging week. In fact, I know from my own experience as the undergraduate president at my college when I was at university that there was not necessarily a desire for them. And there were, one was rejected at my college in short. So I think that transition process needs to be aided. And then I think from that point, it needs to be, there needs to be greater support throughout. I think that the Class Act campaign at Cambridge, which I think came about in 2017, looks to support people from low-income, working-class, state-educated backgrounds, those that are care experienced or estranged from their parents, young carers, these people that have experienced real socioeconomic hardship prior and maybe still now that they're at Cambridge. I think that although that campaign is fantastic and supported by the SU, it needs greater support from the institution to really thrive. And I think that JCR, so the colleges and the committees on the colleges, all of them need to have a Class Act campaign and fully support and throw their weight behind that idea of ensuring that there is someone there for you to talk to for welfare reasons, right? Because every college has an access officer, a student who's age of access. And sometimes it's mistaken that that person is therefore responsible for these issues as well. Well, they shouldn't be. There is a separate position for that that not all JCRs have. Finally, I'll mention, I mean, I have other views, but I'm conscious that I've been talking for a while and there might be something that you want to focus on. I think that every college should have a dedicated individual, member of staff who is trained and highlighted as the person that you go to see if you are experiencing class discrimination. And if you have any of these concerns about how should I approach this, you know, how do I approach networking? I don't know anyone who is a barrister, right? Like, you know, they could have a whole host of responsibilities, but I think they should be trained in the specific issues that are experienced by working class people because, and Rob, I think this is a probably one of those things connected to the Equality Act and its focuses, but there are people at many colleges who have the same responsibility for gender and for race and for sexuality. And if you're an international student, But people from lower incomes, low socioeconomic backgrounds, whatever term you want to use, they are ignored. And there isn't someone specifically for them at all colleges. And I think that is a easy and fundamental change that needs to be made. Beyond that, as I said, I'll be brief. A whole host, I think, of financial changes should be made, which would solve a lot of the issues that I write about in my thesis.
I guess one of the things that I'd be interested to hear your view on. So you've got these various people that represent the problem or you could go to talk about the problem. By the time that the problem has been sort of brought to into one's mind, it's got pretty big. What about the sort of more natural, perhaps organic approach to this sort of navigation at the point whereby these issues occur, a more sort of subtle approach to support?
Yeah, I mean, I think just an institutional focus on this and an awareness that navigating a whole host of elements of being at Cambridge, being at Oxford, being elsewhere is more difficult. So there needs to be greater explanation. There needs to be less assumptions that these things are understood and can be completed without guidance. Would be important. Yeah. But I think ultimately, you know, you can't, no university is able to solve these huge issues that exist outside of their walls, right? Like this is a society, this is a global issue, a society-wide issue, right?
Yeah.
But I think a real institutional focus on making all aspects of university life more accessible, demanding of staff that they ensure that things are accessible and fully, and students are fully informed on them would be important. But I think ultimately, because this is a broader structural issue, a broader societal issue, they will manifest in more severe ways, and there will need to be those people that you can go and speak to when that happens.
Yeah. Got one more question. They say things that get measured get done. So there are measures around sort of social mobility in terms of admission to university. There are graduate outcome metrics. How might you measure, because measuring is important, how might you measure these important things that happen?
So what do you mean by important things that happen, sorry?
So how might you measure any interventions or any support that exists between admission to university and graduate outcome, probably quite some time after people have left university? So you're talking about a span of years, yeah? So what I'm asking is, what could be measured? And I know perhaps it's not very nice to think about about measures and metrics. What sort of metrics might be important to focus the policymakers' attention on this so it doesn't slip through the net?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you're right. There are bits of research that has been done on you know, graduate prospects depending on background. We know that, like, you know, people like Sam Friedman write very powerfully on this. But I think that the changes that I'm suggesting would be important are much more about how people experience their university life, how happy they are there, how well they feel they are fully able to take full advantage of the opportunities afforded to them. It's not necessarily focused on graduate prospects, because I think it's wrong to suggest, you know, that we should be measuring solely things like how many people from working class backgrounds end up working in these top jobs, right? I say that with quotation marks because, you know, you can't see that, but, you know, this idea of top jobs or high pay, high value jobs, because that's not what everybody wants, right? And I think I mentioned earlier my slightly critical or hesitant views around social mobility, in that we shouldn't be expecting, you know, we shouldn't be pushing this narrative that Cambridge or Oxford or university in general is this major stepping stone, this site of social mobility from which you are on an upward trajectory into, you know, A1 job, to going in to be a magic circle solicitor or something, because that's not everybody's desire. Many people want to go back to their communities and work in jobs that they find to be of more social value. So I think any metrics, anything studied, would need to be about experience and about perception of the university, perception of yourself, and really about student well-being more than it should be about graduate prospects. And I think, you know, Cambridge and Oxford don't report on their graduate well-being, is my understanding. It doesn't appear in the league table data, and perhaps that is something they need to more specifically consider.
I totally agree with you, actually, about a healthy scepticism of things metric. Having said that, it draws people's attention. If it draws people's attention, it tends to be taken seriously. Jez, I guess we're coming to the end of our time. Is there anything bursting in terms of what you want to say and talk about that I haven't asked?
Yeah, I suppose just very briefly, just building on this thing about social mobility, I think one of the things that comes out in the research that I haven't spoken about, like it's really foundational to it, is, you know, there's this real obsession in modern Britain around social mobility. We know that successive prime ministers and governments and political parties have focused on it as being, you know, the forefront of their attention. We know that Boris Johnson, you know, spoke about smashing down barriers. Theresa May spoke about this great meritocracy. David Cameron said it was, you know, truly shocking that we didn't have greater social mobility. And I think sometimes social mobility is not fully critically examined by some people. The actual experiences of social mobility, whether or not social mobility is a desirable thing for everyone, needs to be considered. And, you know, I don't have the full length of time that I'd need to probably explain this, but explain my view on this. But we need to be more considerate, I think, about what the social mobility narrative suggests about community and about class, and why those people from working class backgrounds, like I talk about in my research, who are quote unquote experiencing social mobility, might have a lot of troubles with that, because I think that is really quite important. So I suppose what I'm proposing, you know, not that anybody should steal my idea, is a joke. What I'm proposing is a more qualitative and ethnographic study of social mobility that really looks at how it is lived and expressed by the people who are supposed to be benefiting from it. Because, you know, that is not always, I feel, the true story. And it becomes an easy get out of jail free card from politicians and companies as well to push for more of it without questioning what it really means and what it really suggests about the broader structures and attitudes that we have in society.
And I think that is a brilliant point to finish. So, Jez, thank you very much. It's been brilliant talking to you, and I'm sure we're going to hear more from you in the years to come.
Yeah, great. No, it was great chatting to you, Rob.